Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Labrish this evening. If you're on my list, you will know that we're really celebrating a Jamaican who, in my words, did some very great things, not only in my words. I've just discovered her, so I've been so excited about sharing her with all my fans. So as we always do on a Wednesday when we meet here at 8 o'clock to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love, we are going to take a virtual trip to the island. So I ask you to settle in your favorite chair as you would if you were visiting the island or grew up on the island. Just go right back in your memory bank to those wonderful evenings under the mango tree or on top of the roof or on the beach. So for the next hour, you're just going to relax and chill and have a virtual holiday. As we say on the island, no problem, man. So this evening, we are going to be talking about Miss or Mrs. Rosemary Brown. And she was Wedderburn before. So I spoke about her a couple of weeks ago. I think it was 2 weeks ago because one of my girlfriends who lives in Toronto, had sent me a clipping from a newspaper. And I had never heard of Miss Brown before. And I must apologize because I inadvertently, or I made a mistake by saying she was coming out on a stamp in February of 2012. Actually, the email I received only said February. And because I'd never heard of this person before, I assumed it was going to be next year, only to find out after researching her thoroughly today that actually her stamp has been out since 2009. So I want to apologize for that and have it corrected in everybody's mind. Now, I don't know for some reason how most of the people that I've called up and asked, even people residing in Canada, didn't seem to know much about her. So that's going to change because I sent for her book. I think when I spoke about her and Dr. Williams 2 weeks ago, I talked about sending for her book. I didn't know when it would arrive, but I was really thrilled when it arrived earlier this week because now it gives me a chance to give you more information, and I am so proud of this woman because she wrote her autobiography before she died. And I mentioned to some of my girlfriends that after I'd read the first chapter, that it's something that perhaps one of us would have written about our family life in Jamaica. Now, because we are still in the segment where we're doing life in Jamaica the way it was in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it fits right in. So I am going to be reading her first chapter. So So it's just I will be reading her story in her own words. And it brings me to the point that I always try to impress on all of my fans how important it is to write your own story. Or in this case, because you can be a guest with me on Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio, you can tell your own story, because this way it will be in the clouds forever. But for those of you who may not have heard the show 2 weeks ago, I am going to give you a little intro about Mrs. Brown as it appears in Wikipedia. And it says here, Rosemary Brown was born in Kingston, Jamaica in 1930 and moved to Canada in 1950 to study at McGill University in Montreal. She served as a member of the Legislative Assembly, MLA, in the British Columbia Legislature from 1972 to 1986, making her the first Black Canadian to be elected to a Canadian provincial legislature. After departing politics, she became a pioneer for women's studies at Simon Fraser University. In 1993, she was appointed Chief Commissioner of the Ontario Human Rights Commission and served until 1996. In 1995, she was awarded the Order of British Columbia, and in 1996 was named an Officer of the Order of Canada. Brown was sworn to the Queen's Privy Council of Canada as a member of the Canadian Security Intelligence Review Committee from 1993 to 1998. This board is the overseer of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, or CSIS. She also served on the Order of Canada Advisory Committee from 1999 until her death in 2003. She died of a heart attack on April 26, 2003, in Vancouver, British Columbia. So that gives you a little history about her as it appears in Wikipedia. Now, as I mentioned before, on research, I read where she had written a book. And, of course, the first place I went to look for the book was Amazon. And for some reason, it wasn't there. I don't know if it's out of publication or what. But on further research, which I love to do, you know, I just really enjoy Google very much, I found the book and ordered it. So that's, you know, that's what I'm going to read from. The title of her book is Being Brown, a play on words, of course, because her name was Brown. And the caption is A Very Public Life, because, you know, she's, as you can here by all the things I read about her, she had a very public life. But when I read the first chapter of the book, if there are any Kingstonians on the board, you will understand why I got so excited, because she's from the area of Kingston that I was born and raised. But as I mentioned to some of my girlfriends as I was discussing how, you know, how I get animated and like a child when I'm discovering all these fabulous things about my island, because now that I'm retired and it's my passion to put a voice to all of this history, I am like a kid in a candy store when I discover something new. So I hope that all my fans will enjoy me babbling about her with excitement as I read her book. And what I'm going to do, I'm only reading the first chapter if I get to the end of that, but what I'm going to be doing is in between some of the paragraphs, you know, have input from the people on the board, and of course, you know, I like to do my little sidebars. So I see we have quite a few callers in on the board from 973-954-718-305. I want to welcome everybody this evening and to remind you that we're here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. If you do want to interact with me, and remember this is a Labrish, so interaction is expected and welcomed, please hit 1 on your telephone, and that I will see a little hand go up as if you were in school on my little magic computer, and I will open the mic and welcome you. And when you know the mic is open, I will call the area code on the first three letters of your telephone number. So if you hear me say your area code on those three numbers, you know that it's you. I don't know you by name, but you can. I will open you and welcome you on to the backyard. And then you can tell us your name and where you're calling from. So without any further ado, I am going to start reading the first chapter of Being Brown, A Very Public Affair. And I'm not going to read the foreword and all of that. I'm going right to chapter one. When I woke, I remembered the name, but I knew that he was no one that I knew. So if the legend was right, and sleeping with a piece of wedding cake under my pillow meant that I would dream of my future husband, it must mean that I would have to leave the island to find him. Happy with the prospect of a future in a foreign land with an unknown love, I knew that the cake had worked its magic, so I ate it. 45 years later, living in Canada, married for 33 years to a man who was born in the United States, I cannot remember the name of the man of whom I dreamt at age 13, but I'm content that the decision to leave Jamaica in 1950 to attend university in Canada was made in part because of a 1943 piece of wedding cake had predicted it. So that's the first paragraph of the first chapter. And I want to take a little sidebar right away because it brings to memory all the little beliefs that I, at least a few of them, that I remembered my family having. And I remember one of my aunts, the youngest of my mother's sister, putting an egg into a glass, breaking an egg into a glass. One, I don't remember what the day was, and if anybody on the board know what I'm talking about, they can put up their hands and help me out here. It was a day, I can't remember if it was Good Friday, but it was some holiday, and this egg in the glass put out in the sun, and I remember it was out in the sun. In those days, people bleached their clothes in the sun on a zinc, in the sunniest part of the backyard, and I remember the glass, the egg in the glass on the zinc, and I remember that my aunt and the adults in the family swore that they saw an airplane in the glass, but whenever time it was supposed to get to where it, what it was. And for sure, my aunt did go to the United States, I remember, as a youngster, marveling over that. I never forgot it as long as I lived. And for those of you who on the board who might not know, I am quite a senior. But as I was reading this about the wedding cake, I had a flashback of that incident. So as I mentioned, that is the first paragraph in the first chapter. So if anybody have any memories of those old time sayings, put up your hand right now before I get to the second part, because it really brought that memory back to me. Okay, I'm starting again in her book. I was born on June 17, 1930, in the house of my mother's mother in Jamaica, delivered by a midwife. Family legend has it that I was my father's favorite child, that he doted on me. My memory of him is hazy mixture of riding high on the soldiers' shoulders of a tall man who smelled nice, laughed a lot, and filled the whole world with happiness. This is the good memory. The other one is of running around the living room and veranda one afternoon trying to make the grown-ups laugh and play with me, puzzled and frustrated because they wouldn't. The grown-ups were sad, and there was nothing that I could do to stop my mother and grandmother from crying. I never saw the big man again after that. I was never taken on anyone's shoulder for walks, never thrown up in the air and caught, never felt quite so secure, nor ever again smelt anyone like that. For years, I never knew what I had done to make him angry enough to leave me. But I always thought that if it had to do with my running around and laughing while the grown-ups were crying, and I wished that I could tell him that I was sorry. Years later, my nurse told me that I had behaved badly at my father's funeral, that I had run around laughing while the father who had doted on me was lying in a coffin in my grandmother's living room. Now, remember, she was born, this is my sidebar, this lady was born in 1950. And as I read that, I could remember that in those days, that's where people were laid out, not in funeral homes, but in the house. Because I remember going, my mother taking me to several funerals in the country, and I had a young cousin who died young, and I remember him being laid out in his coffin in the living room. So I'm telling you, this book is bringing back a lot of memories to me. And again, as I said to one of my girlfriends, we could have written, because as I go on, people who were raised in Kingston, in the families of those days, can really relate to a lot to what Rosemary has to say. So let's get back to this autobiography. I grew up in my grandmother's house on Portland Road. It was a large place that was filled with the noise of women and children, with their laughter, their joy, their anger, their conflict, their jealousies, and their love. But it was a safe place. The men who came and went, uncles, brothers, cousins, did so quietly and with respect. My grandmother's house was big and old and had many rooms. It seemed to be elasticized because as the number of people who came to live with us increased, rooms would be added on and bathrooms would be added on and the kitchen would grow and the number of small one-room semi-detached houses where maids and garden boys lived would increase and shrink depending on need. It was surrounded by a big yard with lots of trees and bushes, ideal for playing hide and seek, cricket, a doctor with the neighbor's kids and visiting cousins. My Aunt Leela and Uncle Tom built and lived in a two-bedroom bungalow at the back of the yard. There was a large garage big enough to house two cars. Attached to one side of it, under the mango tree, was a large, completely furnished, one-room dollhouse that was transformed into a house for one of the yard boys when we outgrew it. Remember, she had a sister. A large veranda ran around three sides of the house, and on rainy days we would spend hours racing back and forth around it playing catch or some other noisy, touching running game. It was also the stage on which we performed visitors, because the large doors opening into it from the living room meant that not only could the guests seated on the sofa and armchair in the living room be entertained by us, but so also could the maids and other helpers who would sit on the outside step during the performance. When I was a child in Jamaica, children were expected to be polite and courteous and to entertain visitors when they came to call. So I learned to play the piano and to recite poems. The poems became longer and more dramatic as I grew older, and it became clearer that I had almost no talent for the piano. I loved entertaining visitors. I loved reciting and acting out dramatic poems. I loved the applause and the way that grown-ups used to predict great things for my future. "That one is going to be a great courtroom lawyer," some would say to my grandmother. The more religious ones would predict a future as a great preacher or teacher. No one mentioned politics until many years later, which is not surprising. Although our history records, acts of greatness by women during slave and maroon rebellions in Jamaica in 1930s. Let me read this sentence over. No one mentioned politics until many years later, which is not surprising. Although our history records acts of greatness by women during slavery and maroon rebellions. In Jamaica in 1930s, politics was not regarded as a traditional arena for women except as helpers and workers. I never lost my love for drama, and all through my school years, I took elocution lessons and belonged to debating teams. I competed in elocution and debating contests, always with outstanding success. And in time, I fell in love with words. I was a vicarious reader. I was excited by unusual words or unusual use of words. I used to like to play with words, using them in unusual and outrageous ways. I can still remember the first time I heard the phrase infradig. I used it to death. I cherished it, I loved it, I made it mine. Despite this, I never really considered a career in writing, as I did not think I had the talent for writing words or even an outstanding vocabulary, but I love the poetry of the spoken word and of sentences and phrases skillfully and carefully crafted. I used to spend hours listening to the BBC broadcast on shortwave radio just to learn new words and new ways of using familiar words. I love listening to preachers, politicians, teachers and lawyers, anyone who was eloquent. And I used to lock myself in my bedroom and give brilliant speeches to the mirror, debate against myself and dream of being a great courtroom lawyer, destroying my opponent, not necessarily with logic, but certainly with words. Yes, there was no doubt about it. As the saying goes, I was full of myself. The only thing that saved me from being obnoxious was my self-depreciating humor. I laughed at myself and pretended not to take myself too seriously. You see, I was a middle child with an older brother, the only boy in the family, and a younger sister, the baby, who was also retarded. That meant that there was nothing special about me. So very early in life, I learned that to capture attention, to be seen, to be heard, I had to make myself special. My humor and my eloquence made me special, especially to my family. I think that is so beautifully said that, you know, I'm reading it and I'm just smiling from ear to ear. This is my sidebar, folks. Especially to know that this woman wrote this. This book was published in 1989, and she passed away in 2003. And, you know, there are so many other senior Jamaicans that have done wonderful things and have a lot to talk about and brag about and share, but it's hard for them to get to put it on in words and put it on paper, you know. But we'll go on to read. But I think it's so wonderful that this woman is really telling us in her own words about what her early life in Jamaica was. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to share it, because, you know, it fits right in to what I think this segment of the show is all about. And here, even before I go any further, we can see the importance of a strong home with strong women. Because just like I'm sure it is now, for one reason or another, in the old days, it's the women that was the cornerstone of the upbringing of the children, of the homes, of the values. I mean, yes, the men were there, but I think the women, especially for girls, was very, very important to have that. Because I can remember, you know, the older women, much older than my mother, that I interacted with as I was going back and forth to Savlemar, where my mother's family was from, and those in Kingston. That was, and in those days, families were tightly knit. As she mentioned, you know, if you had a big yard, you know, somebody could put up another house to the back, as they did in her case. And everybody would be together, you know, as one big family. So, again, I see that we have callers in on the board. So put up your hand here and interact with me when you feel like it. Because remember now, you're relaxed in your easy chair at whatever part of the island you would chill when the trade winds are blowing gently across your face. It was raining in my city all day today, but it was still a beautiful day. So I hope that you have been transported, since everything is virtual now, to that favorite spot back in your memory bank as I go through Rosemary's autobiography about her early life in Jamaica. And for the fans who are just coming on, and those listening online, I see we have a guest online, and I have my little chat window open this evening. I'm going to let who logged in know that I can see that you logged in. And if you want to put something up on the board that I can respond to, please do so. If you want to let me know who you are and where you're checking in from. It's all up to you, remember. But anyway, I'm going back to my book. I am just really transported back down my memory lane. So let's get back. Jamaica of the 1930s and the 1940s was a wonderful place in which to live and grow up. Through a child's eyes, it seemed to be safe, secure, and beautiful. It was not just the sun and the good weather, which we took for granted. For us and for our friends, life was pleasant and without stress. Amen. She didn't say that. I did. Years later in Canada, a friend commented that the Depression must have been really hard on us in Jamaica. And for a while, I was puzzled as to what she meant. Although I was born during the Depression and was too young to experience it in any meaningful way, because we never wanted for anything or were deprived of anything. We never thought about poverty or allowed its presence to mar our lives until much later. And then it was other people's poverty that concerned us, never our own. We had many friends. No one and nothing to fear. Turin seemed to be protected by everyone. There was no stories of abuse, kidnapping, or murder, and no hint of violence that was to whack the island in the later years. I never learned of incest until I was an adult. Never saw a man strike a woman member of his own family until I came to this country, and she's been in Canada, I suppose, and never learned of rape until then, either. In retrospect, I now realize that my sister, my brother, and I were shielded from ugliness, pain, poverty, and all things evil by a doting grandmother, nurse, aunt, and mother. It was an unreal world filled with people who went to great pains to let us know that they thought we were clever, bright, and beautiful. We seemed to have limitless time to read, to swim, to play, and the only fear that existed was in the tales and legends of ghosts, the duppies, and evil spirits that existed primarily to see that we behaved ourselves. The most important concern in our life was to get a good education. My earliest memories were filled with the importance of a good education. Success in life was measured by whether a person had a good education or not. This far outweighed money, property, or fame. Knowledge was the single most important ingredient necessary to gain the respect of the entire community. And occasionally, when a person would suffer a mental breakdown, there was always understanding and sympathy if it could be proven that excessive book learning was the cause of the onset of the madness. As a nation, Jamaica in the early 20th century had two obsessions: politics and education. My school days started at 6 a.m. with a short walk from my grandmother's house where I lived to the beach, Bournemouth, for a quick swim. When I returned home, I would have a shower and dress for school. Combing my hair was a real problem and quite painful because it was, in Jamaican terms, knotty. To distract me, my nurse developed a routine. Her combing time was used to study the Anglican prayer book or some long passage from the Bible, and everything had to be committed to memory. My hair, which was thick and independent, was tamed by being oiled and braided into three plaits, or sometimes two, with a large bow attached to the end of the braids. Breakfast started with a tablespoon of cod liver oil and a raw egg. After, there was a bowl of cooked cereal, usually cornmeal or cream of wheat, accompanied by a glass of milk and toast. I hated milk. In those days, milk was always boiled. Then the film of cream was skimmed off the top and the milk was chilled. The milk was never really cold enough to my taste, and occasionally some of the cream got stirred in with it, giving the whole mixture a texture that thought of which curdles my stomach even now. I hated it and swore never to drink it once I grew up and left home. Years later, when I became pregnant, I took calcium pills rather than attempt to increase my calcium intake with milk. I used to try to trade my milk away to my brother and sister, and if that failed, I would try to spill it. I guess if I were to be completely honest, I would have to say that drinking milk ruined my childhood. School began at 8 a.m., but because we lived less than a block away from school, we were not allowed to leave too early, for fear of getting ourselves dirty while playing in the schoolyard. Cleanliness was important as a mark of class and status. Very early in life, we learned that people who were dirty were either poor or lazy. So especially for girls, cleanliness was compulsory. Boys were permitted to be dirty so long as it was new dirt, recently acquired in play, or some form of manly activity. No form of dirt was ever acceptable for girls. I loved school and found it easy. I made friends easily, and I was very popular with both girls and boys. The curriculum was very basic and very British, and the emphasis was on memorizing. In the early years, the study of math concentrated on mental arithmetic. The first class was always devoted to some form of mental or memory gymnastics. All the students in the class would be lined up in alphabetical order. Since my name was Wedderburn, I would invariably be near the end of the line with the Wints, the Wongs, and the Youngs. We would then have to answer math questions based on addition, multiplication, division, or subtraction. For each correct answer, we were allowed to move one place up the alphabet. For each incorrect answer, we would move one place down. I was so competitive that finishing below the letter B would send me into a frenzy of study. And in no time at all, the Wedderburns, Wints, Wongs, and Youngs were battling it out for the top spot in arithmetic. Unknown to me, two things were happening. One, an unconscious intent was being formed never to marry anyone with a surname beginning with the letter below C. And two, I was being prepared to dazzle my children with my mental arithmetic wizardry. When they were very young, I used to astound and fascinate them by being able to add and multiply faster than a calculator. They would brag about this at school and bring classmates home for whom I had to perform. That is, until they were in grade 3 or 4. In time, I graduated to high school, but by then, math had become incomprehensive and defeating. English and literature, however, remained my joy and the end. Soon after beginning high school, I discovered the wonder of boys and was promptly sent to Westwood, a girls' private boarding school, for my own good. My family believed that prevention of contact was the best form of sex education. I loved boarding school. It proved, like my grandmother's house, to be a safe place filled with energy and sound of women. My teen years seemed to speed by in a blur of books, boys, dancing, and an increasing addiction to politics. I returned to Kingston to attend Woolmer's High School for Girls for my last 2 years of high school, so that I could graduate from the same private school that my mother and aunts had attended. And I see a hand up, but I can relate so much to everything this woman is saying. I am so happy that she wrote this book, believe me. And I see that we have quite a few people logged on, listening online. So if any of the guests, somebody want to put, say something, please type it on your pad. And I'm going to open up the mic to 954-274. Good evening. Your mic is open. You got Margaret in the backyard. And who do I have? I'm sorry. Who do I have? Nine five four two four two seven four. Did you mean to raise your hand? I guess not. So I'm going to, I see that on my board there's a little thing telling me that number one was hit on your mic. So, again, I'm calling for 954-274. If you want to join the Labrish, introduce yourself now. Hello? I guess not. It might, sometimes it happens by mistake, I guess. So I'm going to mute the mic and ask again if anyone would like to join the Labrish, put in their 2 cents. You can do so now by hitting 1 on your telephone, and I will open up the mic to you. So if 954-274 wants to interact, I think you hit 1 again, and I'll see what happens. Anyway, let me get back to the book, which is, I'm reading from Being Brown, A Very Public Affair, which is the autobiography of Rosemary Brown, whose name was Wedderburn before she got married. So let me go back to this. Now, one day during my very early school years in 1938, the whole school was called into assembly at lunchtime. This was most unusual because assembly was usually scheduled first thing each day so that we could sing a hymn, listen to a reading from the Bible, listen to any announcement about rules, changes in the rules, special occurrences or whatever, then file out and march to our classrooms to begin the academic day. An assembly at noon meant that something special had happened. There was much friendly jostling and whispering as we marched into the auditorium. The most bizarre rumors as to what could have caused this unusual event was passed up and down the lines of students. Finally, we agreed that we either were going to receive an unexpected visit from a very important person, maybe the princess, the Archbishop of Canterbury, or Shirley Temple, because only something of that magnitude could warrant a special assembly, or else we were going to be told of the death of someone very special. When we were all quiet, Miss Wilson, the principal, told us to return to our classrooms quickly, collect our books, and go straight home. She said that there was an insurrection in Kingston, so we were to get home as quickly as possible and to stay inside listening to reports on the radio until it was safe for us to leave our home. There would be no more school, she told us, until the insurrection was over. I never heard the word insurrection before. None of my friends knew what it meant. We all agreed that it sounded serious, sort of like resurrection or some other biblical happening. However, since it was the cause for school being closed, immediately we decided that whatever it wasn't totally bad. We gathered up our books and ran out of the school laughing and yelling insurrection at the top of our lungs. It was wonderful, an unexpected holiday, freedom to play. Insurrection, I shouted as I ran to my grandmother's house. My grandmother told me very sternly that insurrection was no laughing matter, that there was a riot downtown, that some people could get killed, and that I was to sit quietly by the radio and listen to the news. That was the first time that I learned that people in real life really did kill and did die because of their beliefs. This was not stuff in the history books like the War of the Roses. These were people like us who were angry that they were deprived of their right to vote because they were not property owners as the law decreed. They were looting, burning, and even killing each other in the hope that the mother country, as England was called by all of us, would introduce fair labor practices to them. I did not learn all of this from the shortwave radio, of course, but from my grandmother, who sat with us and talked very quietly about the injustice of the system, about why universal suffrage was a right worth dying for. About J.A.G. Smith and Norman Manley and the People's National Party, and about England, the mother country, and about how the meeting that she had been taking us to, the pamphlets that we had been handing out, had failed to influence the mother country, and that sometimes the only language that the mother country understood was violence, and how, although she did not condone uprising, she certainly understood why they occurred and hoped that the army would not be too hard on the rioters. She also added that she hoped that too many lives would not be lost, that J.A.G. Smith would be able to calm the crowds, and that this time the mother country would know that Jamaicans meant business. I became very angry with the mother country that day and remained angry until Jamaica gained independence in 1962. And that is the end of that little paragraph. And when was this? I'm trying to look at the year again. But I don't remember. You know, she, as I said when I was discussing her with my girlfriends, I said in the old days when we were growing up, she's 5 years older than me. She would be considered a big girl. And big girls don't hang out with the young girls. I mean, even 5 years would seem like 20 in those days. So I don't really remember the insurrection thing, but I think she described it so very well, very, very well. So let me go back, unless I see a hand there, I'm going to go back to reading. I'm just have to assume that my listeners and fans are enjoying the book as much as I am. I will be posting on my website, which is backyardlavish.com, www.backyardlavish.com, where I got the book. I don't remember. It's not the regular press that I got it, but it got here really faster than I thought it would. So let me go back to share with you what she talks about her Jamaican days. I think most of the other chapters after chapter one is her being in the university and, you know, how she really accomplished or got the passion to do all she did, as you heard all the things she was involved with that I read about her from Wikipedia. So back to chapter one. One question that is always asked of me is, when did I decide to enter politics? My immediate response usually is, at the moment of conception. I cannot in all honesty remember a time when politics was not being discussed, argued about, disagreed upon, debated, examined, bewailed or analyzed by some or all members of my family. I grew up thinking that everyone discussed politics every day. Certainly in my Jamaica, they did. True, there was gossip about the Duke and Duchess of Windsor and about Jack Johnson and his liaison with white women, but it was just that, passing, idle, small talk. Serious talk was about the children's education and the state of the country. Not even the Second World War, although it consumed our interest for a while, succeeded in distracting us from the words and deeds of our politicians. I suspect, however, that all the political talk that had filled my home and swirled all around me as I grew up gradually seeped into my pores and into my consciousness in my early teens. Yet I cannot actually tell when I decided to become a politician or when I fell in love with politics, Jamaican style. I just know that one day I decided not to become a brilliant lawyer, after all, but a brilliant politician involved in my island's destiny instead. And I began to prepare myself. I've turned the page here. In my family, politicians were held in high esteem. We admired the way they fought the great British government on our behalf. They were our national heroes. J.A.G. Smith and Norman Manley, who were the founders of the People's National Party, based on the British Labour Party model, were giants among the political thinkers of the day. Sir Alexander Bustamante, founder of the Jamaica Labour Party, although he was their ideological opponent, was no less magnificent in intellect and stature. The heroes of my youth were not athletes, nor even entertainers. They were politicians and political activists. Politics in Jamaica of the 1940s and 1950s was a wonderfully, wonderfully heady, verbose, eloquent affair. Politicians were great orators. Heckling was loud and irrelevant, but never vicious. There was always loud music, lots of humor, exaggeration, overstatements, and crowds. Political meetings were held outdoors at major street intersections at night, and everyone turned out for them. These meetings were not just dry, speechless political discussions. There were social events that were attended by both supporters and opponents. Although even in those days, the opposition was always careful not to be too loud or belligerent. Any politician who could not best his or her heckler's with wit and style at such a public gathering was finished even before the ballots were counted. Everyone got into the act, and witty one-liners were repeated extensively, often becoming part of the Mento or Calypso songs that were an important part of every campaign. I recall one campaign in which one of the political parties hired a hotshot New York public relations firm to design its logo and motto. The firm designed a large bird in flight with the motto, "We soar above the rest." The other political party immediately responded with an appropriate logo with a motto that translated into polite language meant, "Beware of the droppings of the soaring bird." In no time at all, the entire island was caught up in hysterical laughter as hundreds of jokes, one-liners, and songs about bird droppings sprang up everywhere, destroying the campaign and contributing in no small measure to the defeat of that particular party in that particular election. Every Jamaican loved politics, was a politician, and an expert on political strategy. The violence and destruction did not come until the 70s. In the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, anger, when it erupted, was directed at the British or some other enemy, never at another Jamaican. In those days, words were the weapons, and outrageous promises the battleground. And the women were as tough, as bright, and eloquent as the men, and it was wonderful to be caught up in the excitement of it all. And with that said, it brings back to my memory the fact that I, too, was caught up in the politics. I remember I came to this country in 1959, and I remember, I think, the night before I got on the plane the next morning, there was a political meeting in my neighborhood. And I remember I was so really fascinated by how eloquent Mr. Norman Washington Manley was with his speeches. And boy, I can remember that last speech. It was just so thrilling. In those days, politics was king. And I want to take a break now because I've been reading a long time. So I have to, again, ask if anyone on the board want to weigh in on this and that period, if you can remember that period in Kingston. I don't know what was happening in other parts of the countries in those days when the two political parties were really hot. As a matter of fact, one of my relatives was the first politician to win a seat in Jamaica from St. Thomas, Vi Thompson. So I remember that the whole family was quite political at that time. And I am the eldest of my generation, and I really remember just being so thrilled with and intrigued by the politics, that when I came here, I wanted my major to be political science. But, you know, it was during the Hoover days, and those kind of things were a little risky. So, again, I see that 954-274 hand is still up. So I am going to open the mic just in case 954-274 would like to join the Labrish. Are you there? I don't know if something is wrong with your phone. I do hear something, but I don't hear anyone speaking. So if you would like to join the lab, say, hello, Margaret, then I'll know that you do. I guess not. So I'm going to close the mic again. Okay, I don't see any hands open. Let me just take a minute to remind the listeners who may come by and folks. You know, all the shows that we have done for the month, for the year, since we started, are all archived on the, if you click on Backyard Labrish on Block Talk Radio, it's there. All the shows are there. You can scan through them. I think they're filed by month as they were done. And you can just pick one out that you might want to listen to while you do your email or, you know, get rid of the junk on your email. And if there's one of interest that you think might interest one of your friends, you can just copy and paste the URL and send it to them as a link. And they, too, can enjoy the Labrish. So it never goes away. It's always there. So I invite you to share what you know your friends may want to enjoy. And if they're interested, you could ask them to just send me their email address, and I'll be glad to put them on our mailing list to let them know what we're going to Labrish about and invite them to join the Labrish. So with that said, I am going to get back to the book. I still see that we have some guests listening online and quite a few who have called in. So remember that this is a Labrish, so feel free to join. So we're still on chapter one. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm finding this book very fascinating because a lot of the things that she talks about, you know, I could relate in my own household because everybody, the uncle-in-laws and was always discussing politics, and the women were just as involved in the political discussion. So back to the book. My grandmother was the first and most political person I had ever known. She was a social democrat. Why or how she became one was never clear to me. I doubt that she ever thought of herself in terms of ideologies. Her doctrine system was quite simple and straightforward. She was a member of the People's National Party. She believed in the basic decency of people. She believed that those who had share with those who didn't have, and that if a government was run by people who practiced these principles, the government would ensure that everyone had shelter, food, employment, health care, and basic necessities needed to cope with and to enjoy life in dignity. She was a profound Christian who experienced politics as an extension of her religious beliefs and always explained it to us as in Christian terms, based on the firm moral difference between right and wrong, good and evil. She had a very special relationship with God. In her home, there was family worship every night. We would all sit at the large round dining table with our heads bowed and our eyes closed, while she had a little chat with God. She would tell him about all the irritations of the day, share with him her concern about our disobedience or other misdeeds, and even tell God of humorous things that happened and chuckle with him about them. As she sat praying with her eyes closed, she could tell if one of us children opened her or his eyes or kicked the other under the table or pinched, and she would immediately bring this act to God's attention as proof of how we tried her patience. After our little chat with God, we would each recite a special verse chosen by her from the Beatitudes. Because I was considered a bit of a troublemaker, my words was, "Blessed are the peacemakers." My sister's, because she was the baby, was, "Blessed are the pure in heart." After saying our verses, we would all recite the Lord's Prayer together, ask God's blessing on everyone, including the king and queen, brush our teeth, and go to bed. My grandmother was convinced that God approved of her politics. There's a break in the paragraph now. I really, really, this woman is writing the book from the heart and just saying it as it is. And for a lot of the Jamaicans, perhaps in the diaspora, who moved to wherever they're living now, whether it's some far place or it's the United States, Canada, but you left in the perhaps late 50s, 60s, you perhaps experienced similar situations in your home because you didn't have to be rich. We didn't consider ourselves rich. But as she mentioned, you know, you had helpers. There were some people had helpers that lived in, as they did in her case. And I remember when I came here first in 59, and I went to the store the first time to purchase a dress or some garment. And I remember the attendant at the store asking me what size I was. And I'd never been asked that question before. And I remember looking at her strange. And I said, "I don't know." And she said, "Oh, my dear, you have never bought a dress?" I said, "No." And she said, "Oh, my goodness." She was in sympathy for me. Sure, I'd never bought a dress because all my dresses were custom made. My body was measured, and the dress was made for me and me alone. So here I am from this country where I went to the store and bought a dress, didn't know what size I was. And when I told her I didn't know, she thought I was so poor that I didn't even wear a dress in my country. As she mentioned earlier in the book, when her Canadian friend talked about how hard it must have been during the Depression. Well, I remember during the war, I don't remember the Depression really, that there was ration books. I remember that clearly, that because everything was imported on the island and the ships would be torpedoed on their way from England to the island, you couldn't get things like condensed milk and things that most everything was imported then, cheese, whatever came in a can, the refined sugar, the rice. So in order for everybody to get some, and the people with money didn't buy up everything, and the people without money couldn't get it, the government, which was the British government then, they came up with this system where you would get a book that would tell how much you were able to buy depending on the size of your family. And I wonder if there are any seniors on the board who remember that period, because I certainly do, when we had the ration book. And when I tell some of my younger friends, they don't have a clue what I'm talking about. And I know I'm not dreaming it. I know it was real. But, you know, a lot of my old folks have gone. I'm the eldest, only one alive in my generation, my mother's generation. So if you can relate to that, or if you're listening online and want to type it in, I have the little chat flash open so that I can respond to that. But I certainly remember that. So I'm going to go back to this very interesting autobiography of From Being Brown, A Very Public Affair. Now she goes on, now I am telling you this much about my family because I am so much a product of their collective molding, shaping, and crafting. Imagine, if you will, a circle. My brother, sister, and me huddled in the center, and all around us, these forceful, dynamic persons giving us their best, lovingly, carefully, painstakingly redesigning us in their own image. When I speak of my family, I am referring primarily to my mother's family, because when my father died, we were so young, the responsibility for our upbringing fell to my mother and her family. My grandmother, Ima Jean Wilson James, was the descendant of an indentured worker from India who came to Jamaica after the abolition of slavery to work in the sugar cane fields. She married my grandfather, Walter James, known to everyone as Pappy James, a pharmacist who was the product of the union of a white man and a black woman. This multicultural beginning expanded until, by the time my grandchildren's generation, it included Germans, Spanish Jews, Americans, Canadians, Chinese, and a member of the Cree Nation. My grandmother had a talent for acquiring real estate, and her finances became the economic basis of our family. She had five children, three girls and two boys. One son and my grandfather died prior to my birth. My mother was the youngest. And being nearly 50 years younger than her siblings was the baby of the family and was treated as such by everyone. Aunt Gwen, my eldest aunt, married Stanley Shackelford and went to West Africa, where she and her husband established a very successful chain of bakeries through Ghana and Nigeria, the Shackelford Bakeries. It was Aunt Gwen who introduced me to African culture. On her visit home to Jamaica, she would bring beautiful pieces of sculpture, brass trays, painted ornaments, and other artifacts, which she would donate to the museum in Kingston. She was an elegant woman with a beautiful singing voice who inherited my grandmother's sharp head for business. The Shackelfords were very wealthy by Jamaican standards, living in grand style when they visited the island, and were very generous. Aunt Gwen, who was herself childless, loved me, pampered me, and insisted on taking full financial responsibility for my university education. Because she spent most of my lifetime in Africa, much of my contact with her was by mail. She was a very generous person whose independence and self-reliance I admired greatly. Aunt Lily, whose real name is Leela James Tomlinson, was the scholar in the family. She was the first woman in Jamaica to win the Island Scholarship to the University of London, England. When she returned to Jamaica upon graduation, she was employed by the government to work with Ruddy Burke in developing a comprehensive welfare system for the island. I'm taking a break here. It's not a break in the book. As I read these names out, some of the seniors on the board may know of them or someone in the family. So please feel free to interact. Because the book is not on Amazon, and I don't know if any of the callers on the board was familiar with it before. I'm just reading the first chapter so you can get a feel for this woman's writing, which it's so just like something I would write, I think, if I ever wrote something. That you know, it's warming my heart to know that she did this and left her mark in so many ways, not just with the book. But at the end of the chapter, if we have time, I am going to be reading what one of the speeches at her memorial service was about, which is so touching. But let me get back to the book. We're talking about the aunt Lil. She was called Mrs. T by everyone and pioneered many of the social services that Jamaica now take for granted. Upon retirement from the welfare service, she was appointed to the bench as a lay judge and remained there until she died at the age of 81. She received many honors during her lifetime, including the MBE from Queen Elizabeth for her outstanding work on behalf of Jamaicans, children, and families of the poor. She was an active member of the People's National Party and remained a firm supporter and friend of the Manleys throughout her life. She was honored by the government in 1975 as an outstanding Jamaican. I spent a lot of my summer vacations with Aunt Lil, traveling throughout the island, visiting the village communities through which the care and welfare of people was administered. I'd learned from her about everyone's right to be treated with respect, regardless of their circumstances in life. I saw poverty at first hand, and I came to recognize that people work very hard yet remain poor because they have no control over their lives and are often the victims of bad, stupid, or cruel decisions made by those who hold power over them. Aunt Lil never content just to help people, always took the time to talk with them about the reason for their condition. She always encouraged them to do as much as they could for themselves, not to blame themselves when things went wrong, and never to belittle themselves or their efforts, but always to try to identify the real source of their problem. She was a political social worker who believed that changing society was more important than changing individuals. Aunt Lil was always teaching us something. She believed in the biblical parable of the talents. She continually exhorted us children to stretch ourselves, our abilities, and our imaginations. She was the first person to tell me how small a portion of the brain we used in our daily lives and how much more we are capable of doing than we actually do. She believed quite firmly that it was a crime to do less than the best one was capable of. And she believed that failure to use a talent would be punished by its loss. She was also the person who taught me that the most valuable gift a person had to give another person was time. She believed that love and loyalty could not be bought with money, but was inspired by the gift of time. To Aunt Lil fell the task of trying to translate my genetic acceptance of social democracy into an ideological framework. She described herself as a Fabian socialist. Although my grandmother gave the impression that she did not think that God played an important part or a role in Aunt Lil's politics, as he should, she nonetheless gave it her brooding approval and was always proud when Aunt Lil could clarify some political act or decision that baffled us. Because of her, I began to read politics and history, trying to make some real sense of all the political talk around me. She encouraged the use of the word why. Always question, she would exhort me. Always seek to know why. Her one caution was always going too far, taking extreme positions, because in that direction, she warned, lurked communism. And the whole point of reading and learning was to have a clear understanding of the difference between these apparently similar political beliefs. To her, communism was a trap to be avoided at all cost, since it was just slavery by another name. But unlike my grandmother, she did not depend on God for protection from that pitfall. My brother, sister, and I were known to my mother's family as the children. My grandmother, like so many Jamaicans before the development of a comprehensive welfare system, adopted children. That means that she accepted responsibility for their financial needs as well as their religious and moral upbringings. On one occasion, when tragedy left three children orphaned, Aunt Lil adopted all three of them, and Aunt Gwen married Uncle Stanley, who, over the years, sired 17 children, none of them hers. Uncle Card had no children of his own, neither did he adopt any. After the death of our natural father, my grandmother, aunts, Uncle Carr all assumed joint responsibility for our parenting, care, and nurturing. No documents were drafted, no papers signed. It just happened. We became the children of the family. Upon my father's death, my mother and the children moved into grandmother's house. Our nurse, Baba, whose full name was Violet Thompson, accompanied us, and as was the tradition, then lived with us and remained a part of my family until her death in 1979. And I have to take a break here because that happened so many times when I was growing up. A family would have a helper who stay with them for life in the old days. But anyway, my uncle, as the surviving male child of my grandmother, assumed the duties of father and became the male to whom we all looked as head of the family. The result of this was that although my mother married a number of times after my father's death, five times to be exact, there was no major adjustment or trauma accompanying the entry and exit of these men through our lives. They remain my mother's husbands. They were never our stepfather. All questions of discipline or future or matters of any importance concerning us were dealt with by my mother in consultation with my grandmother and my uncle. Until she died, my grandmother's house was always considered our home, and she had more influence and impact on our early life than anyone else, with the possible exception of our nurse. After the death of my grandmother, Aunt Lil, who was one of my mother's older sister, assumed the role of matriarch, and the family and took on the duties and responsibilities for the children that had been my grandmother's. While we were relatively young, there was some tension as to where our home should be, since Uncle Carr and Aunt Lil rejected my mother's idea that we should live with her. The children were not included in discussions of this matter. However, we ended up living with Aunt Lil until our late teens, after which we moved to my mother's house. At that time, she had been married to her third husband for many years. The family all liked him, so we guessed that Uncle Carl and Aunt Lil relented and agreed to this transfer. And there is a break in this paragraph. And I know that older people in Jamaica can really relate to this because, you know, the women, and especially the older women, as in grandmother and great-grandmother, they had a lot of say into the next two generations' lives, you know, because they were considered experienced in life. People would listen to them. The younger generation would listen to them, which in her case, her mother and her brothers, the mother's brothers, was the next generation to the grandmother. So you know, the children, as she was a teenager, nobody even consulted them. It wasn't necessary in those days. And I'm thinking how things have changed, because now as you watch the stories, I was watching something on TV last night. I forgot the name of the thing. I'm not a big TV person. Where this young lady, in the case of a divorce, you know, she was living with her father and he needed to move to some other state. And he was making arrangements for her to go to her grandmother and did not consult her. And it really caused a big problem, because she felt that she should be able to make a decision. It was her life. And perhaps, you know, you can say rightly so. But things were so different in the old days. So I'm sure that some of my seniors can really relate to that. I'm back to the book, and I just have very little left. And we only have 8 minutes left. But I think it is really, really so interesting. I was both excited and terrified by my female elders. To me, they seemed overpowering, independent, self-assured, and strong. I was convinced that I would never be able to measure up to their standards, nor carry on in their footsteps. On the other hand, they were very convinced that I could. They had great expectations of me and a very high opinion of my abilities and talents. And like John Donne's God, they encouraged and hounded me, and hounded me even now. I guess psychologists would say that I was surrounded in my formative years by positive reinforcement, which did not entice me to rest on my laurels, but which drove me to live up to the expectations of people who loved me. Today, my friends observing my tendency to be a workaholic are amused when I say that happiness for me is leading a life of idleness, and their amusement at this is tinged with disbelief. They are right, of course, because I suspect that consciously or unconsciously, I am so overwhelmed by the debt that I owe my four mothers and so fearful of my inability to repay that debt in some tangible way or even to live up to their expectations of me that my striving will never end. I am so conscious of the women who are my past that I have come to accept that I see the world through their eyes and react to it as I believe they would. In many ways, this makes life much easier for me, since it relieves me of having to wrestle with moral or ethical issues in terms of my own selfishness and desires. The response of those four mothers to moral issues was always so clear and absolute that I feel safe in always being guided by their example. This, I believe, explains so much of me that is old-fashioned and traditional, as well as why, despite my lack of active involvement with any religious sect, so many of my principles are rooted in biblical teachings. I find it difficult to imagine a time when I will ever be able to turn my back on my struggle for dignity and human rights anywhere. I guess in time I have rolled all my role models into one person who is represented by my grandmother, my nurse, my aunts, my mother, Sir John, Truth, Mary, Mac Loud, Bethune, Angela Davis, and all those tough, strong, independent women who opened doors for me to walk through and who by their lives set standards for me to live up to. Those women have given meaning to my struggle and reason to my life, and they are the strength that I always reach back to when I feel myself going down for the third time. And I'm telling you, I am so inspired by this woman's writing. I am going to ask again if anyone want to chime in to the Labrish. Please hit 1 on your telephone, and I will know that you want to join. And if I don't see any hands, I am going to quickly read what was said at her farewell. I wouldn't call it a party, but gathering. The title is Farewell to a Political Kung Fu Fighter. Sometimes a person's life is so rich and various in accomplishments, friendships, small kindnesses, and far-flung commitments that only when life is ended do all the pieces finally slide into one coherent picture. It's like that with Rosemary Brown, who died unexpectedly in her sleep on April 26 at the age of 72. The pieces of her life make a fantastic mosaic that seems to grow brighter as we all begin to gasp the depth and breadth of her contributions. Like a kung fu movie, we are leaping and kicking and fighting on all fronts. She once joked at a meeting of women in Ghana, "We cannot serve any of our pasts." Pasts. P-A-R-T-S, place them on the back burner. We have to join all fights, all struggles at the same time. She saw that racism, sexism, and economic injustice was intertwined. Rosemary Brown was the first black woman elected to any Canadian legislature, served her Vancouver ridings for 14 years and spent her life in a vibrant, untiring struggle for social justice. The tributes to her began in Vancouver and are rolling across the country like a campaign train. She was the toughly determined executive director and then board president of Match International, a feminist aid organization, which she was beloved. Match workers are reading with tears, blurred eyes. Messages of condolences that are pouring in from humble workers all over the world, civil servants, people in African leaders, Jamaican diplomats. So this woman, this is me talking now, was celebrated so richly in her death. And I'm telling you that all through the book, talk about being able to do what she did because of her roots, because of the grounding that she got in her youth. So I just want to take the few seconds we have left to encourage the seniors to, you know that they have so much to contribute to the next generation. And even though they might be a little troubling and challenging, we can't give up on them. Because, you know, our seniors didn't give up on us. And a lot of times we weren't as straightforward and you know, attentive as we needed to be. And more so, we are needed now. Whether you work in your community, with your family, with your country, with a cause, you know, you are very important to continue the legacy that is so rooted in the Jamaican psyche that I, you know, I celebrate all the people who can relate to the families, the strong families that help them be who they are today. And with that said, we'll have to take up on Rosemary another time because I'm running out of time. And I'm so glad for all the people who logged in. I see we had a lot of people who listened online, quite a few people on the board. And I want to thank you for being there and hanging in with me. And know that I look forward to seeing you next week, where we'll be here again at 8 o'clock to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And I am going to ask, we just have a couple seconds, people can hit one on their mic. Let me know if you enjoyed the show. And I know that I was really babbling all along, but I was reading the book, some of the parts thoroughly for the first time, and I was really carried away because I think Rosemary was really writing for the heart. And I am honored that I stumbled upon the information and have the pleasure of putting a voice to her writing. So I hope everyone enjoyed it, and I hope that you will tell your friends what we do here in the backyard every Wednesday at 8 o'clock, and that you come back next week. And as we say in Jamaica, we used to say, walk good, come back next week, and as I always say, make it a great week. So I want to say good night, and I will see you next Wednesday at 8 o'clock. So thank you for listening, and hope you'll come back when we broadcast again next week. Bye.